The less your business spends, the more margin you keep. But today, everything costs more. So smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one proven platform, helping you reduce IT costs, maintenance costs, and manual errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move to NetSuite. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/earnings. netsuite.com/earnings.
You know success when you see it. Or you think you do. The people in the spotlight. But what about those small business masterminds who succeed at making their money work harder? They do that by having a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, which now earns 5% annual percentage yield. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
Bloomberg Audio Studios.
Podcasts, radio, news.
The story of the UK is an economy that has got real momentum.
What is broken can be repaired. What is ruined can be rebuilt.
UK inflation is becoming much more homegrown.
We have huge potential as an economy in the UK.
This is a time to tell Israel there is a path to peace.
Our plan for the British economy is working, but the work is not done.
Hello, you're listening to Bloomberg UK Politics. I'm Caroline Hepke.
And I'm James Wilcock.
A question for you, James. Did you stay out for the by-election results?
Oh, you're exposing me here, Caroline. I didn't.
Hang on, which is, what does that mean?
Well, I mean, my two great loves in life are politics and sleep. So it was really a toss-up between the two.
So that's a no then.
No, and I did. I mean, I always remember staying up for the Brexit referendum, and I was working at the time, and I was due in the office the next day, and looking at the clock and supposing to go to bed at the exit poll, still being up there at 4 a.m. in the morning.
Yeah.
And then I missed my work the next day.
Oh, wow, did you? I remember a very grumpy husband being woken up as I told him the news. I think he was less interested than I was up or not. Anyway, that's Brexit. Yeah. That's a long time ago. Let's focus on the by-election. Frankly, you weren't alone if you didn't stay up, because actually it does look like a lot of the kind of political commentator community, should we call it that, on Twitter.
I think nerds is the appropriate term.
Political nerds, yeah. On Twitter, or rather should I say X, seemed thoroughly actually uninspired by these two votes in Wellingborough and Kingswood. Does that point towards any results being pretty much a foregone conclusion in the general election?
Well, I think I will let Labour leader Keir Starmer answer that one for me.
But there is more work to do. There's a long way to go. And as every football fan knows, you don't win the league by a good result in February. So we've got to fight. Like, we're 5 points behind in the polls. Got to earn every vote as we go forward.
So they were landslide wins, weren't they? But Keir Starmer was being very cautious.
It is something that he would always be. I mean, I will say the only thing better than by-election is watching the very hackneyed by-election responses from the leaders. You had Rishi Sunak saying, oh, well, the incumbent government never does well. And you had Labour leader Keir Starmer saying, oh, it's no complacency, as they are wont to do. It's all expectation management. However, I will say, Caroline, anyone who looked at the polls and thought the Conservatives were going to win these elections would need their head examining going into it. But we've had a week of very, very difficult coverage for the Labour Party. If you were just to start the political cycle on Monday and ignore the previous 3 years, you would have seen anti-Semitism, you would have seen rowing back on their flagship Green Pledge. I think what has happened today and yesterday with the news about the recession is we've all been reminded the importance of numbers, and Bloomberg, we will always go to numbers and data, that they're is this big cemented lead, and a lot of it is tied to long-term feelings about the economy and competence. And when we look at, we're going to have a lot more stories about Labour drama and Conservative drama, but it's been coming as we get close to the general election, and these results reaffirm that Rishi Sunak has a lot of reputation building to do ahead of the general election if he wants to win.
Yes. And a reminder of the actual figures, Labour managed the second highest vote swing ever in Wellingborough. So a 28.5 point swing from Tory to Labour. And it was just over 16 point swing for Kingswood. So that's sort of the magnitude, I suppose. You know, does it foreshadow then a general election I hate to use this word massacre for the Conservatives, but even Tim Montgomery, who's the founder of the Tory news website Conservative Home, seems to think so. He put out this tweet this morning. It's over for the Tories. Absolutely over. We didn't do what we said we'd do, and we did the things that we said we wouldn't. I mean, that's quite grim.
It is. I don't disagree with the sentiment. I mean, the problem is that by-elections are by nature very volatile things. They are places where people go to express sentiments about the government, which is why incumbents often lose. Rishi Sunak is right to say that, and Keir Starmer is right to say a by-election win does not guarantee an election win. These are true lines, but like you say, the sheer size of some of those swings.
The other point that I want to add in is Reform. This is the party, obviously, on the right, perhaps, of the Conservatives, that the Conservatives have been very worried about. Reform UK's Ben Habib came in third in Wellingborough with almost 4,000 votes, and in Kingswood, Rupert Lowe finished third with actually just over 10% of the vote share. So perhaps the Tories are right to be worried about, you know, Reform cannibalising their support.
I'll make an election data nerd of you yet, Caroline. And well, no, speaking of election nerds, who better to give us the full picture than the expert, Professor of Politics at the University of Strathclyde, John Curtis. John, it seems to have been quite a difficult night for the Conservatives. How bad is it?
Probably about as bad as it could have been and a bit worse than that. True, in Kingswood, nothing spectacular, but the Conservative vote was down by 21 points on the general election, which is pretty much in line with what the opinion polls have been saying. So there's no... Although the swing in Kingswood was somewhat less than some of the other by-elections that we had in the second half of last year, let alone in Wellingborough, still not really much comfort there for the Conservatives. Wellingborough, well, the Conservatives recorded their biggest ever fall in their share of their vote in a by-election they're trying to defend. It was even worse than the previous record, which was in Christchurch back in 1993. Sure, perhaps local circumstances, those surrounding the downfall of Peter Bone may have contributed to that. But even so, the fact that you can record such an horrendous result, it just does not provide the Conservative Party with any crumb of comfort that might make them at all believe with any degree of rationality that they're beginning to close the gap on Labour and to restore their own electoral fortunes.
Wow, so few straws to grab at then for the Conservatives. Can you give us your assessment, a stab at why you think this voting turnout was as it was?
The Conservative Party is in deep electoral trouble, OK? Why is it in deep electoral trouble? Well, there are two ways of looking at it, but they both point to similar directions. The Conservative Party's loss of support in this parliament is essentially the product of 2 6-week periods. The first is the first revelations about Partygate involving Boris Johnson. The Conservative Party lost about 6 points in about 6 weeks, and the Labour Party moved ahead in the polls for the first time in this parliament. And the second 6-week period is the Liz Truss fiscal event and the reaction to that. The Conservative Party lost another 6 points in the wake of about 6 weeks, and the Labour Party moved into double digit leads for the first time. That second theme is picked up when you look at, you know, what are the things, what are the evaluations that people have about how the things are going that are most clearly related to their reluctance to vote Conservative again? And the answer to that question, above all, is their views about the economy. People, 2019 Conservative voters, in the analysis I have done, using a big national academic study, the British Election Study, suggests that amongst those people who think the economy is doing really badly, who voted Conservative in 2019, and there are rather a lot of them, only around a third of them are inclined to vote Conservative again. And just bear in mind, we are talking about an electorate that has been more pessimistic about the economy in the last 4 years than the electorate have been in any previous parliament since 1979, which is basically since records began on this subject. The other crucial issue that is hanging around the Conservatives' neck and is also, again, clearly related to people's reluctance to vote Conservative again is the state of the health service. Levels of satisfaction with the health service have been at a record low. It is not clear that for so long as at least the health service is in the state that it is, that voters are necessarily thinking that tax cuts are a priority. There's plenty of evidence out there to suggest that they won't. But of course, the Conservative Party is embarrassed, I think that's the right word, about having presided over the biggest expansion of the state since the Second World War. Mm. Would love to row it, but that's where their ideological preference, but it's not clear that that's where the electorate are at. And again, so therefore it's not in clear either that some of the remedies, okay. some of the levers the Conservative Party is still hoping to grab hold of will necessarily prove that effective.
I mean, John, you paint a very clear picture there. I was talking to a Conservative strategist just this morning, and he said one bright spot for him is he isn't seeing a core Labour voter turnout on the doorstep. So I want to ask you, do you see this as a Conservative failure or a Labour achievement?
Well, I've already suggested to you in the narrative I presented to you of this Parliament is that it's essentially Conservative mistakes, which are essentially one, Boris Johnson, and two, Liz Truss, which have compounded what has undoubtedly been a very difficult legacy in the wake of the pandemic and the Russian-Ukraine war, etc., and the impact that's had on the cost of living and on the economy. The problem about the combination is that it is oh so easy for the Labour Party to pin the tail of blame on the donkey of the Conservative Party, and you see them doing it in the last 24 hours. They're now calling it Rishi's recession. And I think that's sensible. Now, I mean, to give Keir Starmer his due, the one thing he's done, he has succeeded in making people think the Labour Party is moderate, and you know, much more moderate than it was in 2019. So that may be a facilitating condition to enable Labour to profit from the Conservatives' misfortune. But beyond that, if you look at a number of the objectives that he set out for his party, reconnecting with Leave voters, reconnecting with working class voters, persuading people that Labour Party are competent and ready for government, those things are either at best half done, and in some cases they haven't, frankly, hardly happened at all. Labour have won. I've got themselves in the position they are, despite the fact that many of the things they thought they had to do to get where they are haven't happened, but they are where they are, therefore, because of what the Conservatives themselves have done to themselves.
Do you think they can maintain that stance going into a general election? Because there are definitely Labour Party strategists, I mean, Morgan McSweeney, chief amongst them, who go, don't change anything. This was a great result. We can keep this plan of announcing very little policy heading into a general election campaign. Do you think they will try and attempt that kind of details light campaign?
Well, given they came a bit of a cropper in one of the few policies in which they did have a degree of detail, although in truth, of course, not enough detail. They told us what they were going to do with the 28 billion quid, or they'd worked out what they were going to do with the 28 billion quid a year. They might have not been in such a defensive position. But sure, I mean, the evidence so far is that, yes, the Labour Party probably can win the next general election off the back of Conservative discontent. But I think the question the Labour Party have to ask themselves is, if that's what they do, will that be an adequate foundation to maintain their popularity in government, given the very difficult legacy they will face of a very tight fiscal situation, a flatlining economy, and health services in a poor position? There is a risk, at least, that if all they've done, if what voters essentially have done, is to vote for Labour to say they're unhappy about the Conservatives, and they haven't really necessarily bought into Labour as an alternative, but the moment that things go wrong, this could be a fragile foundation. And I think, in a sense, Labour probably now need to be a bit more ambitious. They need to think more about what is the minimum we need to do to win the next general election, but rather to think about what do we need to do so that we can minimise the risk that we will face during what will be a difficult period in government if indeed they do manage to win the election.
We're also thinking a lot about the technicalities. Turnout seems to have been pretty low for these by-elections. Everyone's trying to figure out when Rishi Sunak might call the general election. Will it be October, November? What about turnout?
Well, I mean, on the timing of the election, there's nothing in these by-elections to suggest that Mr. Sunak should go any earlier than he feels he needs to. And, you know, basically November is the last decent date. You know, I think, that seems at the moment all too clear. On turnout, yeah, there is a story. It's an important story, not for necessarily one particular party, but for everybody. In this parliament as a whole, take all the by-elections in this parliament, we are now on average recording a record level of fall in turnout since the last general election. It's running at 28 points. The last time it was anything like this was the parliament of 1997 to 2001, at the end of which turnout was only 59% in the general election. It's still a record low. And I think, you know, there's a general question facing our politicians. So I already suggest, you know, Labour may want to do more to enthuse voters. The Conservative Party certainly need to do more to make voters feel happy about them. But all of them, in a sense, have to ask a question. Why is it that an electorate that seems to be deeply discontented, perhaps is deeply pessimistic, deeply concerned about the state of the public services, also seem to be drawing the conclusion, some of them at least, it's not clear that it's worth voting for any of them? And there is certainly, I think, quite a substantial risk for this and for other reasons, that we are heading for a low turnout election, which in a sense, in the end, a win is a win, and Labour Party will take it. But obviously, to some degree, at least, it will take the shine off the win, if indeed it's off the back of what might be, in some senses, a relatively limited mandate.
Professor of Politics at the University of Strathclyde, John Curtis, thank you very much for joining us.
So that then on the by-election wins, but of course it comes in a week in which we discovered that the UK did indeed slip into a mild recession in the second half of 2023. There had been a hope that we might have skirted it, avoided it, but in the end, the latest data shows that the last 3 months of last year wasn't as positive as we'd thought. Now, this is going to make Jeremy Hunt's next budget in March even more tricky. Reports out today in UK newspapers suggest that Hunt has deemed a previously planned income tax cut unaffordable. So do economic headwinds force him to make tough choices between public spending and tax cuts? Joining us now to discuss is Matthew Lesh, who is Director of Public Policy at the Institute of Economic Affairs. How difficult a position do you think that these latest figures on the economy put Jeremy Hunt in when it comes to public spending and the possibility of tax cuts, about which we've spent many months thinking about, and the ones that Tory MPs want?
I mean, obviously the news that the economy has fallen into recession is quite devastating for the government, who've made this central promise to get up economic growth. But of course, by all reports, it's expected to be a pretty shallow and short dip of a recession and a swift recovery. The longer term issue for the government, though, is the fact that we're having almost two decades of practically zero or almost zero economic growth, of an era of stagnation. So then you come to whether or not the government can get on with its agenda here when it comes to tax cuts. It seems to me in the first instance that there's an obvious absurdity here, that the government fiscal policy is set by week-to-week changes in Office for Budget Responsibility forecasts, which are based on these fluctuating bond yields that have a big impact on whether or not the government's borrowing costs are going, expected, I should say, in 5 years' time to be going up or down. But that seems to be the way the government's chosen to operate. And in that context, they're saying, well, we want to get down taxes, but at the same time, of course, we're putting up taxes to a 70-year high. So there's just a whole bunch of contradictions here. And I think there is obviously a case for tax cuts, particularly ones that reduce disincentives to work, that encourage investment. Whether or not that's affordable for the government is another question, particularly when they're not willing to have a more serious conversation about the other side of the ledger, which is all the increased spending that they've planned.
I mean, Matthew, you talk about sort of week to week, sort of fidgeting almost on policy. I think it's worth talking about which tax cuts. I mean, because we seem to be changing minds on which ones they are, according to if you read most of the reporting. In your mind, if you were in government, say, which tax cuts would you be cutting first as a priority?
Well, I mean, from a political lens, it seems the government's insistent on, I suppose, something more of a kind of a Keynesian stimulation kind of a tax cut. You know, let's just give everyone a little bit more money before an election. I'm not sure that is necessarily the best approach or should be the purpose of tax cuts. I think going back to that point about what are the taxes that discourage people from working? So there's quite heavy, I suppose, high marginal tax rates at certain levels of income. That we know discourage people from working, particularly when it's unfortunately not particularly politically sellable, but for people who earn between 100 and 125,000 pounds a year and are getting child tax credit, there's a big disincentive to work there. Same for people around who go up into the higher tax bracket over 50,000. And because of bracket creep, you're seeing a lot of discouragement of work. I think on the other end of that, you'd like to see an expansion of investment incentives in the corporate tax system of course, they've just put up corporate taxes again, but 25% is not exactly the most competitive corporate tax rate internationally, particularly with Ireland next door to the UK. So it's those kind of taxes which we know discourage investment, discourage work, that economically speaking, the government should be focusing on.
I wanted to pick up on something else you said about the OBR's forecasts, because I think you're right. You know, we do focus on the OBR's forecasts. And something else that we've heard a lot about recently, Bloomberg has reported this, is that Jeremy Hunt's considering public spending cuts to help fund any future sort of tax cut. Now, a word that I'm sort of been fascinated by that's starting to prop up again, it comes back from the austerity area, is civil service efficiencies. The idea being that we'll promise that kind of money will be saved from government in future dates, and yet that money never is saved because that means cuts, effectively. And so I wanted to ask you, Matthew, in your sort of very esteemed positions outside of government, commenting in, where you think Jeremy Hunt should be saving money if he wants to make these kind of economy-boosting tax cuts that you back?
Well, I think indeed that is the central challenge here, which is everyone wants to promise tax cuts and no one wants to do any kind of meaningful spending reductions. The problem is, and this, you know, to some extent was also the issue during the Cameron Osborne era, which is the government does like to do these very broad-based spending cuts, but without actually reducing the promise of what government is expected to deliver. So just putting less money in and expecting the same output is not precisely the right approach. I mean, I think I would like to see a focus on public sector productivity and public sector reform to get down the cost of delivery. And this isn't an impossible task. The UK is spending less per pupil on education than it did 10 years ago, but educational results are actually better than they were in the past. Now, it's the inverse in the NHS, where the government's spending significantly more than a decade ago, and the outcomes are much worse. So there's got to be some capacity to improve public services in a way that doesn't require as much spending. I think it is also...
But that's sort of, that's asking for a kind of a golden solution, isn't it? I mean, for there to be improvements without more it's how you get to those. Economists and business leaders, you know, are pointing to the UK's chronic underinvestment versus peers like the US and Germany and France that mean that we've got this weak productivity and dismal growth. Everybody wants to see more economic growth. But, you know, it has to be about surely leveraging government and business investment in order to, you know, get people to make longer term commitments. That surely has got to come now from a new Labour government. There is so much lack of optimism, lack of hope that the Tories can come anywhere close to another election win.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. I don't think there is much hope in a future Tory government. I don't think there is much vision coming out of the government. I'm not sure big state-led investment projects have a particularly shining history. You have to get a little bit worried when the government says, you know, we're going to pick
Inflation Reduction
or pick
Act
these companies.
In the US under President Biden is hundreds of billions. It's enormous. It's a massive, you know, state thumb, as it were, on the the UK is not doing that, but they are voting.
The UK isn't doing that, and a Labour government aren't going to be able to promise that for the same fiscal restraints that the US doesn't quite face. The US, as the world's reserve currency, can borrow a lot more and get itself into a bit more of a fiscal mess than the UK can. I think at the same time, we should be a little bit sceptical about something like the CHIPS Act or the Inflation Reduction Act. Of course, there's a massive amount of government subsidy going to industries. That will do something. That will create some kind of economic activity, especially at that scale. Whether or not that is particularly high productivity or particularly meaningful is another question. There hasn't been at least as of yet, a massive movement in semiconductor factories to the US, and the companies that have promised that in the past haven't quite achieved it. So I'm not sure that going back to a kind of 1950s, 1960s industrial policy approach with the state picking winners is necessarily going to have the desired outcome. And I'm not sure Labor in the UK quite has the fiscal resources to do that. I mean, are they going to put up taxes in order to fund that? Are they where are they going to find the borrowing? Or will the gilt markets react negatively to that and push up borrowing costs? So and I think they've acknowledged this problem as well, that it's not exactly a comparable situation.
Now, I appreciate, Matthew, your reluctance for the IEA to be associated with Liz Truss, but I can't help but point out that the IEA's former director, Mark Littlewood, has become now the director of Liz Truss's popular conservative movement. So do you support the popcons?
I mean, the IEA is not a political group. The IEA is an educational charity, and we're almost forbidden by law to be involved in politics. So, of course, Mark has moved on from the IEA, and of course, we wish him well in his new role with Popcorns. I think it's a bit of a different vision, though, compared to the IEA. Particularly, a lot of the focus of Popcorn seems to be on things like immigration and cultural issues, which aren't necessarily the IEA's bread and butter. In fact, the IEA in the past has most spokesperson of the IEA have been pretty pro-immigration, whilst the new kind of Popcorn movement seems to be very sceptical about immigration, to give one example there.
Do you think, in terms of an electoral sense, let's come back to this idea of Mark's sort of history and the troubled history with sort of the Conservative Party and this trust, that in some ways it's poisoned the well? You're making this economic case for tax cuts, you're making this case for productivity coming, and yet it's going to be a deeply unpopular decision that, like you yourself say, it's worrying about how it might impact the polls. Do you think in some ways it's traumatized an electorate?
I mean, undoubtedly Liz Truss is a very unpopular figure. At the same time, I think that there was a substantial contribution, at least rhetorically, from her time in office, which is this rhetoric around growth and economic prosperity that seemed to have been lacking, but now is almost bipartisan. You see, Keir Starmer will rightfully highlight the fact that the UK hasn't grown and that we're now entered a recession. And I think there's no bigger political issue than that. And there's a lot of different ways that we can boost productivity. I think the biggest one that needs to be addressed is fixing Britain's planning system. So allowing more homes to be built in places where people want to live, building infrastructure, allowing infrastructure to be built, allowing green projects to go ahead. That there's so many impediments created by the planning system that addressing that alone could deliver huge amounts of economic growth to the UK. And it's been excellent to say that Labour's been talking about that issue in a way the Tories have rhetorically talked about it, but never really achieved that much.
Absolutely. The quest for growth for Britain, the fundamental thing that will bring up living standards for people in the UK, for voters, surely we all have to cheer for that. Matthew, thank you so much for being with us on the programme. Great to have a nice robust back and forth about policy at this time. Matthew Lesh is Director of Public Policy at the Institute of Economic Affairs.
That's it from us for today. If you like the programme, don't forget to subscribe and give it 5 stars so other people can find it on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen.
Well, this episode was produced by Tiwa Adebayo, and our audio engineer was Marufa Hussain. I'm Caroline Hepke.
And I'm James Walcock. We'll be back with more on Monday. This is Bloomberg.
Bloomberg UK Politics. Listen weekdays at noon on DAB Digital Radio in London.
From Silicon Valley to Wall Street, the promise and perils of artificial intelligence are playing out on the world stage. But what will the next phase of AI adoption look like? Which companies, from big tech to startups, will dominate? And where do the risks and unintended consequences lie? I'm Emily Chang. Join me at Bloomberg Tech in San Francisco, May 9th, to answer many of the industry's burning questions, alongside Snap's Evan Spiegel, Xbox President Sarah Bond, OpenAI's Brad Lightcap, top researcher Dr. Fei-Fei Li of Stanford, and many more. More details and just a few tickets left at Bloomberg.com/TechSF.